We're going to talk now about Dr. Seuss, and you probably already know the controversy. So Dr. Seuss Enterprises is ending future publications of 6 Seuss books that include offensive imagery, such as depicting people of color through racist caricatures, using images that reinforce racial stereotypes. In a statement, Dr. Seuss Enterprises said, quote, "The books portray people in ways that are hurtful and wrong," end quote. Now, a firestorm has ensued since the news with claims of cancel culture. The books aren't being canceled. But the Springfield-born author and his estate have certainly given us cause to talk about stewardship of artistic works and when it's time for something to be sunsetted. So we want to invite you to join us to talk about this. What do you make of the recent controversy surrounding Dr. Seuss's legacy and those 6 books? Do you think it's cancel culture, or is this cultural wisdom? Where does this move fit in our current racial reckoning? And do you think taking the books out of publication was the right move? We welcome your thoughts at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. We have 2 guests for this discussion. First, Boston Globe film critic and columnist Ty Burr, and also Tricia Elam Walker, writer and assistant professor of fiction and creative nonfiction at Howard University. Ty, Tricia, welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana.
So, Ty, I want to turn to you right out of the gate, because I understand that you're kind of frustrated to even have this conversation, that so many people have bought the framing of cancel culture. So talk about that a little bit.
You know, I just feel like we walked into just an absolute, not a trap here, but we just fell for something here that was framed by Fox News and right-wing media to have a big cultural kerfuffle over something that is not that big, and we can get into that, because when we're talking about this, we're not talking about the Senate making a recovery deal. We're not talking about the attempts to stop voting and block voting down in the South, and the Voting Rights Act. And we're not talking about all the things we actually need to be talking about. We're talking about 6 old Dr. Seuss books. And you know what? I fell for it. I wrote a column last week. You fell for it. We're having this conversation right now. There are other things to be talking about.
So I do wonder, though, Tricia, and Ty, I appreciate your point, but I do wonder if this invites us to have a little bit of a different conversation about thoughtful stewardship. So I'm thinking about, I'm thinking about both your column and also, Tricia, I'm thinking about Jabari Asim's point in the Boston Globe, that these are books that should be in the library, but probably also on request, or at least not in the picture book part of the children's section, because that's the more thoughtful approach to when and how young kids should encounter such content. So does this invite us to not fall into the trap Ty's talking about, but have a conversation about thoughtful stewardship?
Well, yes, and I agree with Ty. This is not about cancel culture. I think it's about evolution. It's about reckoning. It's about taking responsibility. And so I'm actually pleased and proud that, you know, the Seuss Enterprises did this, because it seems very thoughtful. They looked at these books. They consulted with experts, and they realized that some of them didn't make sense at this time. They weren't contributing anything. As a matter of fact, they were detracting, and they were possibly being hurtful, as they said. And I think that's really important, because one of the first rules to me about a children's book is it should never do any harm to a child.
So, Tricia, you had an early exposure because your mother was the head of the library program for the Boston Public Schools. What did you learn about Dr. Seuss back in those days, and how does it compare to the conversation we're having today?
Well, my mother, yes, she did that, and she was, she became sort of out of necessity an expert about racism in children's books, because she was tasked with making sure Boston Public School libraries were filled with books for all children, in which all children felt good and felt celebrated. And I do recall that, and I don't know that they were these specific ones, but probably.
Okay, I think we might have lost Tricia there. And listeners, you didn't know this, but I think we actually had lost Ty. Tricia, do I have you back?
Yeah, somehow the mute came on by itself.
Okay, glad to have you back.
I don't know what you missed, but I was saying that my mother's job was to make sure, you know, the Boston Public Schools libraries were filled with culturally diverse books. And also, you know, when I grew up, there was a dearth of books about children that looked like me represented in a positive way. So she was always on a quest for that, and really, you know, perturbed at the dearth. And when she would come across books that had representations that weren't positive, you know, those books were not the ones that we paid attention to or were able to, you know, explore further. And I remember her feeling that there were some Dr. Seuss books as well as some others, some books that I actually loved, like Pippi Longstocking and the, I think it was The Charlie and the Chocolate Factories, and many others that had some issues in them. So while we still loved and read the other Dr. Seuss books, you know, she felt it was important that we not read the ones that might make us feel bad or might make us feel shame or might make us have questions that we didn't need to have at that point. A children's book should help a child celebrate him or herself, all kinds of children.
So you agreed with Ty, and Ty made a really compelling argument. We'll get him back in a minute. I know they're working on that now. At the beginning of the segment, that we kind of fell into a trap in our public discourse on this because it was framed as these books being canceled. They are still in libraries. You can still buy them. They're just not going to be published anymore. But what about, Tricia, the concerns that this could represent the first step in a slippery slope? So you stop the publishing today, but that limits access. Tomorrow, the books eventually disappear over time. It has a chilling effect on other authors, potentially early in their career. So, you know, that argument is there too. What do you make of it, and what would you say to it?
I mean, I think that's a pretty weak argument. I think these are books that were already sort of kind of obscure. They were already books, you know, that people recognized had problems that weren't relevant. And there's so many others. And one of the things I think his estate said was, you know, they want to make room for more relevant books and books that are actually contributing positively to the conversation. So I don't really see it as a slippery slope. It's not being totally canceled. It's not being censored. It's just being moved out of the way for other books that can actually contribute in a much broader and more helpful way, I think.
I think we have Ty back now. So Ty Burr, welcome back. I was just asking Tricia about concerns that maybe this represents a slippery slope, that this is not a cancellation, but does it lead to a chilling effect? Does it lead to cancellation? Tricia answered that question. It made me think of another. You had a reader respond to the op-ed you told us you wrote that likened the ending of the publication of these titles to burning books. I do think it's important to call out that's a false comparison. These are books that being burned. They're still available. But talk about why it's a false comparison. And Ty, have you given any thought, is there a comparison that you think is better and healthy in understanding why Seuss Enterprises is doing this in this moment and why these kinds of decisions are coming up now?
Well, for one thing, I will certainly agree. I was able to hear, even though I was cut off there for a bit. I certainly agree with Tricia when she talks about young kids of color trying to see themselves in these books, and they're not there. And I actually, there was one tweet that was put up by a guy named Michael Harriet that I'm just going to read because it clarified things for me very well, where he said, here's the thing, I understand why they can't understand it. Who cares if Dr. Seuss was racist one time in that one book? Should he be canceled? They don't realize that the only time a black child saw themselves in a Seuss book was in a racist illustration. And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. But to your point, what I honestly, you know, in my column, I compared what's going on now to the early Tintin books by Hergé, which are really, yeah. Tintin and the Congo is a profoundly racist book. And it's not available to the family audience as part of the regular run of Tintin books. It is available in a scholarly edition for collectors, for academics. It's not gone. And even if that had ceased publication, you can still find copies of it pretty much everywhere. My point about the not publishing these six books is, well, first of all, it will still be available in libraries. Yes, it's $600 now on eBay, but after this hysteria dies down in 6 months, you'll be able to buy a copy of McGillicuddy's Pool for $25 or $10 on eBay. It's not going to be that much of a deal. Second, books go out of print all the time. The number of books out of print compared to the number of books in print is, you know, bigger by an order of magnitude. And third, I think it would probably behoove the Seuss estate to at some point make these things available in editions that discuss the issues, that frame them in terms of history, in terms of context, in terms of culture, and not put them out there for the kid market. But for now, I think it's a perfectly appropriate first step.
Right.
So I want to, yeah, go ahead, Tricia.
I'm so sorry. Some books
no.
I heard LeVar Burton say some books just don't age well. And I think that's the case here. And I think we also have to prioritize the needs of children. And a lot of these discussions where people are talking about canceling and banning books, they're not thinking about the children here. And I just want to give you a quick example. I integrated a private school in Boston when I was 10 years old, and we had to read Huckleberry Finn, and we had to read it out loud. We had to read passages out loud. And I remember dreading and hoping I didn't have to read. I was the only Black girl in that class, hoping I didn't have to read, you know, a sentence with the word. But of course I did. And it was, it was traumatizing. I mean, I'm still, this is 60 something years ago. I still remember how I felt. I was holding back tears. I felt like the whole class was looking at me like I was. And, you know, it was a problem, and it should not, I never was able to see the value of that book because of that trauma. And I don't think that should happen to a child. Children's books should be celebratory. Children should feel good after reading them. First, there should be no harm done. And what's represented about a particular child should be authentic and true.
So, Trisha, I really appreciate that story, and I'm sorry for the pain of it. I also do want to acknowledge that you used a character name there that we don't usually use on air in public radio. And I just do want to acknowledge that for our listeners. It's not my main focus, though. My main focus is the pain of the story that you just told us, and the fact that this is where the engagement on this conversation goes now, that we are in a moment in our racial reckoning where we're having real conversations about the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves and how we can do better in that. I wonder, Ty and Trisha, if either of you have encountered books for children, books for young people that you feel are now the role models and maybe the future Seuss books we read our kids that are doing a better job of telling us the stories we tell about ourselves. And I'd invite listeners to call with those same thoughts. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Trisha, well, maybe you first.
That's the wonderful thing. There are so many. There obviously could be more, but there are so many more books. I just also remember back in like 1962 when The Snowy Day came out, Ezra Jack Keats, a white writer.
Yeah.
He had this beautiful round, velvety little Black boy and his mom, and all he was doing was going snowing, and it just showed a Black character doing a regular event, and it was a positive story. And then, you know, and then more and more of these kinds of books started coming out. So I'm actually a children's book writer myself, and that's one of the things I try to do, you know, with my books, is that really represent us authentically, positively, so that a child can read it and feel good. That's the objective.
Ty, any thoughts you want to add to that?
No, you know, my kids are grown, so I haven't read children's books in quite a while. I will, you know, absolutely reiterate the love of Ezra Jack Keats. His stuff is fantastic. I do think there, you know, when you look back at classic kids literature, we do have to read it with an open eye. But that said, there are plenty of examples there that you can find that are, you know, really challenging and enlarging and fulfilling without getting, you know, problematic one. I'm thinking of like the work of Tove Jansson, the Moomin books, which are kids, you know, for kids like, you know, 7 to 11, but they are completely unobjectionable, but also impart lessons that are really, I think, useful and have a sense of poetry to them that I think are really good for children to sort of be exposed to.
So one of the things, Trisha, go ahead, Trisha.
A lot of them discuss topics that are difficult topics, you know, but they do such a warm opening, wonderful way. I mean, Kwame Alexander has books like this, Jabari Yassin. My book is called Nana Kula Goes to School, about a little girl whose grandmother has traditional tribal markings on her face, and she's worried that the children at school might make fun of her, but she learns a lesson about that, you know, about appreciating and celebrating difference. And I think there is a richness now in the literature that I'm so thankful about.
I'd love to go to the phones here. We've got Antonio on the line from the West End who has a question for the two of you. Antonio, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon, Tiziana, and thank you to the speakers for the wonderful context you're giving. I just wanted to know if you could add something about how nostalgia plays a big problematic part in addressing all these products. I grew up watching Tom and Jerry, and you know, Now I realize that while it was a great introduction to classical music, it was also a great introduction, a terrible introduction to family racism. Mm-hmm. And I think that happens a lot with cartoons or short stories that a lot of us grew up with.
Antonio, thanks for the question. I want to give you both a chance to answer that. Ty Burr, I'll go to you first because I heard you giving some sounds of agreement there. So,
yeah,
Ty, why don't you start?
Well, I think one of the reasons this particular case is such a hot topic, and the reason that it's been leaped on by right-wing media is that everybody loves Dr. Seuss because everybody read Dr. Seuss when they were a kid, and so it's innocent. It therefore represents their innocence. They didn't have a problem with it then. Why should anybody have a problem with it now? It goes to what I call the footy pajama theory, sort of sardonically referring to movies that you saw when you were young enough to be in footy pajamas, and then you love for the rest of your life because you have absolutely no critical distance on it whatsoever. For me, that's The Wizard of Oz. For some people, it's Star Wars. For some people, it's The Lion King, whatever it is. These artifacts, and it's useful to think of them as cultural artifacts, they are so embedded in our childhood that it hurts to think of them as hurtful. And it's a challenge to us. And this is what I've been seeing in the response to my column, and to Jabari's column, and to, the whole public discussion, is that people are angry because they feel personally attacked, because these are books that resonate with them on a personal level. And I understand. I love McGillicuddy's Pool. It's a beautiful piece of work. The illustrations are lovely.
Tricia, let me let you add on there.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think we also have to remember that, our country is going through a difficult period right now with racial reckoning on many levels. And so we have to be, aware of that. And there are all kinds of things that maybe we had felt nostalgic about in the past, but that are just not appropriate anymore. I think about the Native American mascots, Those are the things that need to go at this point. Those old cartoons, my kids can't watch them. I couldn't watch them when they were growing up because they weren't appropriate anymore. So, we have to move forward. We have to continue to evolve with the evolution that is happening in our country and in our world.
So let's go to the phones here. We've got Lauren on the line from Winchester. Lauren, go ahead.
Hi, thank you guys so much for hosting this. I am a mother of a 3.5-year-old and I have struggled with finding books that have been diverse and representative. And it's a struggle raising a white child in this country, honestly, because, you really want to provide as much diversity as you can. I just wanted to give a little shout out to a local press group. Mango and Marigold has a wonderful line of really diverse books, Mango and Marigold Press, and I've really found a good connection with them.
Great, Lauren. Thank you for that. So it's great to have those recommendations, for parents to share with each other other things they're having their kids read. It does, Tricia, Ty, it does also raise, I've heard parents having conversations now saying, well, wait a minute, does this mean I shouldn't read Green Eggs and Ham to my kids anymore? Or One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish? I hear from you that's probably not the message. But Tricia, we may as well take it head on. What about that?
No, I think keep reading those books. I don't see any issues with those books. Dr. Seuss himself evolved. He looked at some of the work that he did for some newspapers, the cartoons he made, and he felt embarrassed about them and didn't feel comfortable having those being shown anymore. So, what he tried to accomplish was to bring joy, to teach some things to kids, to have them be fun. And those books that are still available that don't have any of those problems in them serve that purpose.
Yeah, and
so,
I would chime in.
Go ahead, Ty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go.
I would chime in that there's, along with Dr. Seuss, there's a sort of history of these mid-20th century illustrators who sort of come of age. And Hergé with the Tintin books is another example. His early books were really quite racist. Then he was befriended by a Chinese national who really opened his mind about depicting the other cultures in his books realistically open-mindedly and democratically, and it really changed him. The same with Seuss. If you look at his early cartoons, they buy into the sort of the cultural blackface tropes of the 20s when he first started out. And you can see him evolve through his career to the end when he's, doing the Lorax and the Butter Battle book, and he spoke of those early works as with shame. is, you know, on the record about it with his family.
I think Ron Dahl tried to do that as well, didn't he? He went back and changed something, the Oompa Loompas, and I think that the Chocolate Factory books.
The Oompa Loompas were originally a tribe of black pygmies that were, quote, imported by Willy Wonka. The NAACP protested, and he heard them out, and he said, you know, once I heard them and other people, I had sympathy for them. So for the second edition, he changed they changed the illustrations and he changed the descriptions in the book.
Right.
So we're coming close to the close here. There is one more question I want to ask you both to reflect on, which is, we will continue to deal with this duality, which is so often the case, of artists who move us and they teach us, but either they are also deeply flawed people, because many of us are, or they have some work that is flawed or represents a different time and needs to be reckoned with now. Is there a framework or a guide that you use? How do you think about encountering and thinking through that work? It comes up all the time in art. Tricia.
I feel like the test is, you know, can you read it to a child of color without them feeling shamed, without you having to change something because you realize, oh my gosh, there's a problem in this book. Can you do that? Can you read that book and the child feels celebrated and goes away feeling good about themselves and is not harmed, then it's okay.
And Ty, how about you?
I would say, as somebody who has two kids in their mid-20s, you can read some of this stuff to them and they will respond sometimes with vehemence and horror at some of the things that are in these books. And that's a good conversation to start having. I'm not going to say that they're always going to be right, but that conversation, if you show some of these books to somebody, to a young person, to somebody of the younger generation, they will respond honestly. And it's a good litmus test of how things are playing in the culture now. And I think that's a good starting point to start arguing about how you deal with these particular works of culture in the culture. How you frame them. And again, I'm not at all in favor of banning the books, but framing them, contextualizing them, talking about them.
Well, that is Boston Globe film critic and columnist Ty Burr, and also Tricia Elam Walker, writer and assistant professor of fiction and creative nonfiction at Howard University. I want to thank the both of you for engaging in such a thoughtful and nuanced conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.